Okay, folks, welcome once again. This is Elvin Shamroff here. And welcome to one of our last of the year, last few teleconferences. We've lost basically half, two-thirds of our audience, and so as the exams happen, we're losing more and more people, and that's absolutely fine. We even have at this late stage people who are signing up for the first time. So for those people who are here for the first time, the way this works, we've got two people today, I believe, who have submitted questions. They're not sure how to handle, how to defend. Outside of the fact that I've read the email of their cases, I haven't discussed it with them. It's not pre-scripted, and I keep this totally focused on exam, how to handle these issues in the exam, and I also make sure that the issue at hand, which is the case 99% of the time, is relevant to everyone. So I'm hoping you'll find this helpful and valuable. Let me just see, is Ashley, are you there, Ashley?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great, wonderful, welcome, and thank you. Now there's another person who presented his or her case and gave her name as anonymous. So I'm going to shout out, if you are anonymous, are you there? You can stay as anonymous, it's absolutely no problem. Your case would be a 18-year-old Gravita 1 at 36-6 with an MBA.
Yes, that's
you. Great, wonderful.
Yeah.
So can I ask you, no obligation, but instead of calling you anonymous, can you give me your first name perhaps? Or any name? Say again?
You can call me Esther.
Esther, that's fine. I don't care if your name is Jane. It's more friendly to call you by a regular name than anonymous. So Esther, is it? That's fine, perfect. Thank you so much. All righty. So let's get straight on with it. Esther, why don't we start with you? I've had a look at your case. It's a great case. It is highly relevant to everyone. It's pretty straightforward from my point of view. But that being said, why don't you go ahead and present the case, and then we can talk about it.
Okay, yeah, this was a 18-year-old G1 T0 who presented at 36 weeks and 6 days after a level 3 motor vehicle accident. We were called down to the trauma bay, and we put the baby on the monitor. A patient was complaining of back pain, you could see that the baby was having a moderate variability, but recurrent D cells, had limited prenatal care. But basically the concern was, given the high-speed accident, there was concern for placental abruption, particularly from the patient's symptoms and also the tracing. And then the emergency medicine team needed to do a full-body CT scan before bringing her up to L&D, so we kept a nurse with her. And then in the meantime, we got some of her labs back. Her fibrinogen came back, I believe, 39, and so we were very worried that she was in DIC, so we immediately, as soon as she got to the floor, did a stat primary section. She did end up requiring the massive transfusion protocol with, I think, five units of blood, a pack of platelets and I think 4 units of FFP. And then she was admitted to the ICU after her section. And as you can see, she required all the things, including uterotonics, Bielen, Spockery, everything. On post-op, 1 developed a fever, a low-grade fever, and then on further workup was found to have a PE, for which she was started on anticoagulation therapy on post-op day 1.
Okay. So let me tell you, it would never happen, but you could almost have, there's so much in this case, you could almost have your whole exam just on this one patient, but that would never, ever happen. So, folks, let me share with you a few things that are important and relevant to everyone. I'm going to obviously get into the abruption PPH issue ultimately, but there are a couple of other things that I want you to understand, you specifically, Esther, as well as everyone listening, based on what you say when you present can generate some questions that you might not have initially thought of. So, mm-hmm. with this in mind, I'm going to throw some of these questions at you, Esther. And that is, you've got a patient who's been involved in a head-on motor vehicle accident. She had minimal prenatal care, but if you do have a patient who comes in for prenatal care, how would you counsel patients regarding the use of seatbelts in a car? What would you say?
Oh,
you see, you've got a straightforward abdominal trauma abruption PPH case, but now it can grow tentacles. And you probably can see why that question actually is reasonably well-founded, given the fact you've got this clinical presentation. So go ahead. Let's hear what you have to say.
I would counsel the patient on the importance of wearing their seatbelt in the setting of pregnancy and also outside of the setting of pregnancy, and that it would be imperative and saving if she were to get into a car crash to be wearing her seatbelt and to wear it appropriately.
Okay, so from the exam point of view, you've got to be just a little bit more specific, and that's why I'm raising this for everyone listening in. And a lot of you have an abruption on your case list, and so you can be asked this very easily when it comes to abdominal trauma. The key thing to mention as far as seatbelts are concerned, there must be, which is pretty standard today, there must be a shoulder harness. It must be a 3-point as opposed to a 2-point seatbelt. And the shoulder strap should be placed above, not over, the pregnant abdomen. And then the lap portion of the belt needs to be placed very low down on the lap, so that the belt actually goes below the superior anterior iliac spines of the pelvis. That way it stabilizes the pelvis, which is really what you want to accomplish. So I just want to mention that. Also, you've got a situation of a patient who may require a stat C-section. Okay? The realization that this might occur, and folks, you may not have the same case as Esther for the rest of you listening in, but the clinical situation can still arise, that you may be called down to the ER and you see a baby with a terminal bradycardia, for example, or in this case you sent her down for CT with a nurse. Was she sent down with a continuous fetal monitoring or no?
Yes. Nurse was performing.
Okay, so it makes my point even greater. The question that you, Esther, in this case, need to be, I'm not saying it's coming up, but you need to just review it just so that you've got it covered, okay? And the rest of you with similar scenarios, just be able to speak very briefly to it. Don't be caught unawares of this. The question is, if you were forced to, what are the issues, Esther, that you would consider if you had to do a stat emergency C-section under local anesthetic? What would you do? Now let me tell you, in the exam, 5 seconds of silence is a very long time. You probably didn't expect that question, and you need time to collect your thoughts, and that's okay. But I just want all of you to be aware that 5 seconds of silence is a long time from the exam point of view. So keep that in mind. Esther, go ahead.
I would ask the ED providers to provide me with Betadine and a scalpel. I would make sure that there's a labrant. When the OB trauma page goes out, we would have made sure to bring a hemorrhage cart, as well as an OB nurse and tech would also come down. But I would just ask the ED providers for a scalpel and do a slap.
Let me cut to the chase with you, Esther.
Yeah, go ahead.
There are two or three issues that you've got that the examiner's waiting to hear you say. Number one, you've got to be very careful of getting into lidocaine toxicity. So you've got a limited amount of lidocaine that you can use. And how much is that? And since mm-hmm. you've got a limited amount of lidocaine, you can't go injecting it all over the show. You've got to use it very sparingly. And so which are the layers, as you get down into the uterus, which are the layers that require infiltration with lidocaine? And then finally, what are the signs and symptoms of increasing lidocaine toxicity? Okay? So can you do any of that for us, Esther? If you're not ready for it, it's a tough question. But if you've got a case like this, it's a potential question. Any idea?
I would answer with what I know, which is for lidocaine, in terms of the limits of what I would want to give, I would give no more than 4 mg per kg, so weight-based. That would be the max I would give.
I've never done this, and it's been a while since I read it, but 4 milligrams per kilogram. The figure that I want to say is 0.7 units per kilogram. Ashley, you're there. Can you help us out? Do you have any idea?
On the maximum, I don't remember what it is.
Pretty sure.
Okay.
And with epinephrine, it's 7 mg per kg, or 4 to 5 mg per kg for just lidocaine. But if you add epinephrine, you can go up to 7
you
mg
go
per
more,
kg.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. It sounds like you know it. So, folks, I'm not going to be dogmatic that what I'm saying is right. The principle is, I want you to realize that if you've got this kind of a case on your cases, this becomes a fair, reasonable question. Okay, what layers need infiltration?
I definitely would inject subcutaneously.
No, skin. Sub 2 has no pain fibers. Skin you need to
skin.
Do. Okay.
Skin, yeah.
I think that's what you meant to say when you. Okay,
yeah.
But I guess I'm being over picky. You want to do skin, but the needle goes just below the skin. Okay, I hear you. Go ahead. Yeah.
And then, like you said, the subcutaneous layers don't necessarily have nerve fibers, and then. I don't know, fascially, I'm not sure.
No to fascia, yes to parietal peritoneum, and yes to visceral peritoneum.
Okay,
now, those are simple squamous epithelium. It's very thin, so it's not so simple to do that, okay?
So skin and peritoneal layers, and then I would go ahead and do the procedure? Is that I guess I've just never done.
Yeah, that's correct. How would you do the procedure any differently, given the fact that this was being done under local? And by the way, you could ask for IV sedation as well. Just FYI. But how would you do your actual surgery differently?
I would do a modified Joel Cohen incision and do 2 to 3 big swipes in the center, couple centimeters.
So, no, the key thing I'm looking for. It's preferable to do a midline vertical incision. That's number one. But the key thing is don't exteriorize the uterus when you suture it up.
Okay.
It should be a minimal manipulation technique because the bowel wall is covered by peritoneum and it's not anesthetized. And don't, for a similar reason, don't pack the paracolic gutters. Okay? Give me quickly the side effects of increasing lidocaine toxicity.
I think there's initial signs of like perioral numbness, tinnitus, and then the concern would be for altered mental status or cardiac toxicity or cardiac effects.
Cardiac arrhythmias, cardiac and respiratory depression. Yeah, very good, very good. Okay, I just wanted to go through that very quickly.
Yeah.
Folks, virtually every one of you have on your cases either PPH and or a blood transfusion. Now, this case over here happens to be a pretty severe blood transfusion. When you get to these massive blood transfusion protocols, you know, when you're giving more than 6-8 units of whatever you're giving, you don't need to know ultra detail. But for basic blood transfusion, you do. So you've got to be able to say what blood did you give her and why. How many units did you give her and why? What are the pros and cons of cryoprecipitate versus FFP? When would you give platelets? What would you expect the platelets to do to the platelet count? This kind of thing is very important. And because virtually every single one of you have it on your case, I encourage every one of you, it's one of the few things that you've got to know in reasonable detail. Know blood component therapy very well, okay? What you don't need to know, and probably 20% of you have a case like this on your case list, a patient is in the ICU. You don't need to know the ICU management and, you know, all the arterial catheters that they put in and the pulmonary balloons that they put in and all that kind of stuff. You don't need to know that. So don't freak out about that. And then in this case, it's almost like a by-the-way issue. You mentioned that she presented with a postpartum day number one fever. Folks, I just want to share with you that postpartum or post-op fever is a wonderful exam discussion to have. The key things you've got to keep in mind are what's the differential diagnosis, all those W's, okay, wind, water, walking, etc. And what's also important is you want to be able to try and correlate or share with your examiner how you narrow down that differential based on how many days post-op or postpartum the fever starts up at. So if it starts up day one, day two, you're going to think of things like DVT. If it starts day seven, you know, it's a different differential diagnosis. So just be aware of that. And then finally, actually, before we talk finally, you've got a PPH here. This is probably the most commonly asked question, clinical issue, in any OBGYN board exam. I don't care if you're taking the DO exam, ACOG exam, Canadian, it makes no difference. You've got to know it backwards. And I would just encourage each and every one of you, because virtually every one of you have at least one PPH case on your case list, I encourage you to present the management in the following lines. I would start off by talking about mechanical PPH management. And some of you who have been listening to this over the year, you've heard this before. Mechanical PPH management, and that means suturing local lacerations, uterine bimanual compression, uterine massage. The next thing is pharmacological PPH management, and this is your Pitocin, Methogen, and Prostaglandin. Then you get your surgical PPH management, which is your Bakri balloon, B. Lynch stitch. It's nice if you've really got a severe case to be able to say the basic principles behind a hypergastric artery ligation. Not that any of you should say in the exam you would do it, because to all intents and purposes, none of us have done it before. And if we were to try and do that under emergency circumstances, let alone elective, we would probably kill the patient. So if this issue comes up in the exam, it's nice to be able to say, you know, I would not do this. I've never done one. I would do more harm. So I would not do it. But these are the principles behind which it's done. And if you can say two or three things on that, that's great. But don't be forced to say that you will do it, because that would be harming the patient. Unless you've been trained, that's a different story. So we start with mechanical PPH management. We went to pharmacological PPH management, surgical PPH management, and then finally you can add a hematological PPH management, which is blood component therapy. Okay, that if you think of your PPH management in that kind of vein, I think it'll help you in your presentation. And I also probably 5 to 10% of you have C hists on your case list, and obviously the hysterectomy portion would come under the surgical management. Now, finally, on this case, the big issue is the pulmonary embolus. This is a favorite exam question, and it probably is a function of DIC, I'm guessing. Just be aware that PE and DVT often go together. You could start off with one and land up with the other and vice versa. All I'm going to tell you is this. Any of you who have shortness of breath, respiratory distress, dyspnea, if you've got those words on your case list, you've got to be able to have a conversation on the differential diagnosis of shortness of breath, of which PE is the biggie. And when it comes to PE, you've got to be able to describe how you diagnose it. First of all, what's the differential diagnosis? How do you diagnose it? And then what's the management? And anticoagulation management is pretty important, to the point you need to know it in, I would say, moderate to reasonable detail, okay? Especially if you've got a patient who's a history of DVT, then how would you manage that patient during her pregnancy? How would you manage her in the ninth month as far as anticoagulation is concerned? If she was going to have an elective induction or C-section, what would you do the day before the induction or C-section? What would you do the day of, and what would you do immediately postpartum? It becomes a very detailed discussion as you get around the delivery period, and you've got to know that fairly well, okay? So I just want to share with you that P and DVT are really very important, and at the end of the day, I think this case is more a PE discussion, but it can also be a PPH discussion. I've been talking a lot on this. Have I answered the questions that you may have, Esther? Are you comfortable with this?
Yeah, well, just it was just a very complicated case. I was just concerned that they would be worried that I didn't manage the patient more, like do her sex, like the fact that she had to be cleared by emergency medicine first, and then.
No, on the contrary, I would say you called it all the right people that needed to be there. And you've got a very, very sick patient for whom there's a mortality, and you've got a good end result here. I don't think you need to feel bad. On the contrary, I think you should feel comfortable. But just be ready for these conversations. That's the key thing. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
One last thing. You folks don't know this because it's not... Esther didn't mention it in the when she presented, but it's down on paper. You gave the cord gases with a pH of 7.22 and a base excess of -4.
Yeah.
So I'm from the experience of reviewing multiple taste lists, I know it's not common at all. Excuse me, for candidates to put down cord gases. If you have, I hope the only thing you put down was a pH and nothing more. But Esther, you did, and some of you listening in may have on your case list a base excess or something more than just the pH. And so I'm really going to depress you a little bit because I'm going to tell you just ever so briefly be able to say one sentence on how you might distinguish or what are the differences between metabolic versus respiratory acidosis. Okay. And if you don't get that question right, it's also not the end of the world. So I don't want anyone jumping off buildings because they can't handle the answer to that question. All right? Esther, that's it. Any other questions that you may have on this case?
No, that's helpful. Thank you so much.
All right, sure. Very good. Excellent. Okay, Ashley, you're up. Go ahead. You discussed your clinical setting of your practice, but for the sake of this conversation, go ahead and tell everyone listening in what your issue is.
Sure. Yes, my issue, so my OB cases are from a year I did as a laborist, and so I didn't manage patients prenatally. I didn't do the prenatal workups or any, of that care. I primarily met my patients the day of delivery. And so, I've been told that when they go through your case list, consistency is very important, and so I was trying to keep that in mind when doing my case list. But now that I'm going through even with a more fine-tooth comb, I'm noticing perhaps there are things that should have been done in the prenatal workup that weren't done, or even things like aspirin prophylaxis that, probably should have been recommended that weren't recommended, or, certain counseling, things like that. It worries me that, they'll take it as like an inconsistency of my list, that wasn't necessarily my management.
This is a good question. I'm pleased you've brought it up. It's not a problem. And a lot of people listening in will have the same basic principles, but in a multitude of different kind of clinical settings. It might be a candidate who's been given a case list by ACOG because they're a laborist and they can't generate a GYN list. It might be a subspecialist who can't present an REI, who can't. No, that's
right.
A bad example. Contraceptive fellowship who can't generate a GYN list. And you've got cases that were given to you or cases that were done during residency or cases that were referred to you by colleagues outside. And you didn't do the workup. The point is this. The basic principle in how to handle this situation, which is not uncommon, is to be, and those of you that came to the course and heard me say this multiple times, just be open and honest about the circumstances of your practice. So Ashley, you should say in the exam, if they say, I noticed this patient didn't get many aspirin. The way you deal with that is you say, you know, you're quite correct, and I can tell you throughout my cases, you'll find some patients did get it and others didn't. It was inconsistent. And the reason for this is I'm a laborist or whatever, and I never managed these patients. They all came to me for delivery. So some of them got it, some of them didn't. And so you state the circumstance which explains why there's an inconsistency. But that's not enough. You've then, if you stop there, the examiner will ask you the question, but you can preempt that question by just saying, but you know, if I would have been managing this patient, my indications for giving mini aspirin are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So give them what you would do. And at the end of the day, that's the bottom line. That's what they want to know. What would you do? Even though you're a laborist, they're giving you a license to practice as a generalist. So you can go and get a job, a locum tenens in North Dakota, and they've got to be comfortable that you can, you know, that you can manage general OBGYN. So if you can just share with them, you know, why there's an inconsistency, and then tell them what is your management principle, they can't ask for more. So that's what I would recommend. Does that answer your concern, Ashley?
Yeah, no, that helps. I was just getting worried looking through that they would take it as like my list is messy or not, you know.
No. And for everyone listening in, this is common, okay? And there may be one or two inconsistencies on your part. That can happen as well. And if you've got that, you can say, you know, sorry, I muted myself. Ashley, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. You maybe have made an inconsistency yourself. And what you say is, you know, again, be open and honest. You said in preparing for the exam, after I submitted my cases, I noticed there was this inconsistency. And as a consequence of this inconsistency that I picked up, I've now changed the way I practice. Whenever I have clinical scenario X, which can have two possible options, I now make certain I go with option A because I believe it's the best one. So I have a protocol that I've instituted to avoid this inconsistency and making sure that the patient always gets the better of the two options. Again, you just show the examiner that you understand the issue, you know what's important, and that you're a better physician for it. You wouldn't have killed anyone because of, you know, this inconsistency. So it's just the bottom line, be open and honest. Okay? Ashley, does that answer your question then?
Yes, that helps. Thank you so much.
Okay. Any other questions that you may have?
In relation to that, no, I don't think so. I guess,
okay.
When we're studying our case list, since in OB, you know, it's primarily delivery, but how much story, like, I guess, do we just talk about when they were, the decision for delivery was made, and then just see how much they asked beyond that? Like, I guess when you start from the beginning.
No, that's not the way to go. You obviously have to be able to explain what you did and why you did from right. the moment you saw them. But and this is a general principle for everyone listening in. Let's say you're on this, you're coming on at 8 o'clock in the morning, and you see this patient, she's 8 centimeters dilated, and you go ahead and deliver her, and she's a pregnant cardiac. So how did you deliver this pregnant cardiac? What did you do? That's obviously fair game.
Mm-hmm.
You actually are asking the question, how much do I need to know about her prenatal course being a pregnant cardiac, of which I had no part? Am I correct? Is that really what you're concerned about?
Well, I would, as the person who's delivering, obviously, I would want to know about the patient before I'm delivering them to know their risks and how to manage them. So,
for your current management,
I would know that. Yeah.
Correct, but I think you, in terms of potential questions that can come your way in the exam, I would encourage each of you to go a little bit further. And what do I mean by that? You've got to know what was important to you at the time when you first saw her and how you managed her from that point onwards. But in the example that I gave of a pregnant cardiac, it can be a patient with antiphospholipid syndrome, anything.
Yeah.
You've got to be able to say, it's not fair for the examiner to ask you, how did you manage this patient during the prenatal course? Because you didn't. So it's an inappropriate
right.
question. So if they were to ask you that, you would say, I only saw this patient when she was in labor. I never did the prenatal care, but you can't stop there. However, if I would have been the one to see her during her prenatal visits, these are the things that I would have kept an eye open for. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You understand? You've got to be able to give that extra bit. It's the same issue as I mentioned before. They're giving you a license not just to deliver patients in labor, but to provide prenatal care as well. So you've got to show them that you're comfortable to handle that aspect of OB. All right?
Yeah. Got it.
All right. Any
Thank
other
you.
Questions, Ashley?
No, that's it. Thank you very much.
All right. You're welcome. You're most welcome. Folks, we're almost done. I just want to encourage you to have as much mock oral practice with colleagues, with friends, with us if you wish, but just practice speaking as much as you can. I want to encourage you again to go through your cases very carefully, try and work out what are the probable questions they're going to ask you based out of the curiosities that your case list might present to an examiner. And then if there are any questions that you come up with which are reasonable questions and you're not comfortable to answer them, just look up a little bit quickly so you can say one or two sentences on that should that question come up in the exam. But it's really not the time to be studying textbooks and chapters and reading articles. That's really this very superficial stuff now. Practice talking, and not that you'll listen to me, but it's time to start easing off. I know you won't because you're all type A personalities, but it's time to start relaxing, okay? It's probably falling on deaf ears, but that's okay. You'll realize in 6-12 months' time that I was correct, but that's okay. Folks, the next teleseminar is going to be in 2 weeks on the 12th of November. If any of you are interested in doing our pre-Dallas exam finishing touches course designed to be taken the day before the exam down in Dallas, I'm almost certain Several of the sessions do still have available, some availability. Some of them are fully booked. We can take, I think it's only a maximum of 8 people per session, but I think only a few of them are fully booked. So if you're interested, just get in touch with the office and they'll be able to tell you if it's still available. So to Esther and Ashley, thank you so much for volunteering. Tell your friends to come and join us next time around on the 12th. And that's it, folks. Thank you so much. All the best of luck in the exam. And for those who are still around, we'll do this again in 2 weeks' time. Thank you so much, folks. This then concludes our teleseminar. All the best.